our record Keep On Dancing was moving up the charts. We were in high school, and one of our first tours we did, we missed a whole week of school for this, was with Dick Clark's Caravan of Stars. And I never will forget this. Dick Clark pulled us into a room before the show, everybody, and he said, look, be on time on this tour, be dependable, make sure your outfits are in mint condition. He said, remember one thing, when you're on that stage, make sure you give the audience everything you've got, especially with your dress, because remember, if you dress like the audience, one day you're gonna wind up sitting in the audience, which means be colorful, be flamboyant if you can. And that's why to this day, in the wrestling crazy world I'm in, I always wear the Jimmy Hart's Blue Light Kmart Special Jackets, or what I call them, the black ones with the red hearts, or the white with the red hearts, or when I managed the Hart Foundation, it was all the pink stuff, or Hulk Hogan red and yellow, or even the Honky Tonk Man with musical notes. But I never will forget what Dick Clark told me. Ring, ring. Hello, it's Cindy in. What? You gotta be kidding me. She went to where? To see who? Rick Springfield? I called my chick on the phone last night. Her mother said she was gone for the night. I had two tickets to a rock and roll show to see her working class hero. So I cruised in my car and I cruised downtown. I could hear the music playing from a mile around. So I bought me a ticket and I walked inside. I could see him standing there in the spotlight. Eat your heart out, Rick Springfield, 'cause she's my girl and she always will be the only one for me. Ain't no rock and roll singer gonna take her away from me. My musical memories kind of were about to, my mom really kind of got me involved with it first. Sadie Nordenhart, she wrote a song before I was born for Eddie Arnold called Enclosed One Broken Heart. And I guess she had it in her blood, and I guess it got transferred over to me somehow, because I remember she used to take me to church every Sunday and I had to sing in the choir. And then I had to sing solo. She had my hair all curled up. I mean, it was, really looking back at it now, I looked kind of goofy back then. Matter of fact, I probably look a little goofy now in these jackets. But she started me off early with all my singing. And then, of course, in high school, I was in the choir. And that led on to me, helping form the group, the Gentrys. And like I said, lucky that she got me into the music business, because if not, I probably wouldn't be sitting here now. The way the Gentrys got formed, we were in high school. We really got out of it to cut class, you know, because that way all of us had last period study hall. Well, all we do is go to sleep in study hall, right? So they let us, there was a musical class that we could take. So they let us put a band together. And so we put a little band together, and we called ourselves the Gents at the time, G-E-N-T-S. So what we would do, we had seven of us. It was myself, Larry Raspberry, Larry Wall, who was our drummer. We had Bruce Bowles, who was one of the singers. We had Bobby Fisher, who played saxophone and keyboards. And also we had Pat Neal, who was our bass player, and Jimmy Johnson, who played organ and played trumpet. So we had a little bit of everything going on. But we put a band together called the Gents, and there was a show that came through every year at the Mid-South Fair called the Mid-South Talent Contest. And so if you won that, you got a trip to Miami Beach to be part of a big show down there called Ted Mack's Original Amateur Hour, which is kind of like American Idol now. So we went down there. We won the talent contest in Memphis. And all of a sudden, we drove to Jackson, Tennessee, and we took the train from Jackson, Tennessee, down to Miami Beach to perform on Ted Mack's Original Amateur Hour. So we performed on the show, and after 4 weeks, the results came in. The Gentrys won. So the next trip, we went to New York City to appear on Ted Mack's and Radio City Music Hall, by the way. So 4 weeks after we performed, we won again. This is great. If you win three times, you got a record contract. In the meantime, though, that's when we had cut the record Keep On Dancing, and it became a local hit for us there. So it kind of made us professionals, is what they said. But they still made us go back to New York again for the third time, even though they knew we were going to be disqualified, right? So we think we still had more votes we should have won, but it's kind of like everything else, you know. It's kind of like the wrestling business, you know. Anything can be changed at any moment. Well, the songs that we played as the Gentrys locally, we'd play the T. Walker Lewis YMCA on weekends and different high school functions back then, on sock hops back then, really. And like I said before, the songs we do covers. We'd play Louie Louie by the Kingsmen, or we might do Twist and Shout by the Osley Brothers, and a lot of Sam and Dave, Hold On, I'm Coming, because, you know, being from Memphis, that was a big soul element in Memphis. You know, Nashville was always kind of country music, but soul music really came from Memphis. Stax Recording Studio, and of course, Sun had all the rockabilly stuff with Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins. And so the music we'd do a lot of covers back then, because we really wasn't writing anything original. And originally what happened, there was a group called the Avanis, a black musical group called the Avanis, that had Keep On Dancing out first. But they did a slow version of it. They kind of did like, Keep On Dancing, woo! You know, that slow version of that particular song. When we cut it, we just kind of speeded it up. And with the drums, where the drums kind of went, Keep On Dancing. So that's, I think, what made it unique for us, because even though it was a cover, a lot of people forgot about the original version that the Avanis had out. The journey in the music business, and it wasn't very pretty at first, let me tell you this. I mean, here we are in a station wagon going up and down the road, doing the cover songs and Keep On Dancing. After we had cut it locally in Memphis, what happened? A guy named Chip Smallman came to town, and his claim to fame was a producer. He had produced a few records on a few stars back in the past, but he was kind of regrouping and coming back. Our lucky break came from a guy named George Klein. If you look in all the books on Elvis Presley, George Klein was one of the original members of the Memphis Mafia. George Klein and Elvis became friends in high school. I think the story goes, at Humes High School, Elvis was fixing to walk into the bathroom. And when he walked in there, he was warned before he walked in by George Klein, because George Klein was in there originally, and he heard of three guys that said, look, when Elvis comes in, we're going to get him down and cut that long black hair. Because Elvis was different back then. He always wore the white bobby socks, but he had the pants legs cut up and a lot, you know, turned up. A lot of people didn't. He always had his shirt sleeves worn up. He wore the black shirts or the tight white shirts back then. So he kind of stood out, but he was different. That's what made him such a big star, because he was different. But George Klein warned him, he goes, look, Elvis, just want to tell you, don't go in the bathroom today. These guys are waiting for you. So because of that, they had a great bond. Well, how did that really help the Gentrys? Well, later on in life, when George Klein was on a show called Talent Party on WHBQ Radio, he's the one that saw us in one of the eating places in town and knew that we had a local record out being played back then. And he had us on Talent Party and filmed it. Talent Party was a show that if all the groups came to town, like the Dave Clark Five or Paul Revere and the Raiders, they'd always go right to Talent Party and film a segment on that, because that was shown on every Saturday. And George would play their records too. So George Klein kind of discovered us, got us to come in, cut a little demo record, which was Time Is On My Side by the Rolling Stones at the time when we did that. But that led to us eventually cutting Keep On Dancing. But we used to play the YMCA and all the places I told you earlier. But, you know, we'd have the little U-Haul truck or trailer that we'd carry our little equipment in. And it was hard getting in a station wagon, getting all seven of us into a car, by the way, let me tell you. But we did everything. We were kind of our own setup crew. We set our PA up. We set all the equipment up. Then we'd go back and change clothes. And then we'd come out and do our 4 hours little set a night. Then we changed back into our clothes. We were kind of our own band and on road crew back then. What was television like back then? Excited to be on the shows. It was great, because locally, Talent Party was the big thing for us. Then, of course, then came the Ted Mack's Original Amateur Hour, that everybody was to see this all over the U.S., really. But we came back, and that's when we found our song Keep On Dancing. And we cut the little cover of Keep On Dancing, our version of it. But back then it was so easy because you could get your local records played back then. So all the local radio stations were playing Keep On Dancing for us. Well, what happened, Chip's Moment pressed about 5,000 copies of it. And we sold every one of them locally at a shop called Poplar Tunes back then. That was a big record shop back in the day. And so they sold out. Well, Chip's got a hold of MGM Records. So MGM came in and said, well, look, this could be a fluke hit because these kids are from Memphis. Sure, their high school fans are going to buy it, and a lot of the people listen to the radio. Why don't we do this? We'll put 5,000 copies of it out in Nashville and get airplay, and we'll put 5,000 copies of the single out in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And if it gets airplay there and sells there, then we'll give you a deal on MGM Records. So our fingers were crossed. Well, they put them out there. About a month later, buddy, they signed us to a deal because they kept reordering and reordering in those towns. I think it wound up selling almost 20,000 copies in Chattanooga and almost 35,000 singles, which was unheard of back then, especially for a local group back up in Nashville, Tennessee. So they gave us our deal. We went in and we cut our album, our Keep On Dancing album, right there at Memphis, Tennessee, on the steps of Memphis State University. But then that's when everything went crazy. All of a sudden, here we are on tour. Our first tour, you know, of course, Dick Clark's Cavalcade of Stars. We went out for about 7 days on it. We got out of school to go on that. And we were on there with Sonny and Cher and the Beach Boys and Chuck Berry. And that led to other tours after that. We did other TV shows with Dick Clark. We did Hullabaloo, Shindig, Where the Action Is. So many other things that happened. Then we did a little movie called Bikini World. And so everything really went great for us. We played the Whiskey O'Go-Go, and our warm-up group at the Whiskey O'Go-Go, who didn't even have an album or a single out then, was the Buffalo Springfield. And I never will forget it, because on their breaks, we'd play an hour, they'd play an hour. But on their breaks, we had that hour to do what we wanted to with it. I'd go next door to the Roxy, and Little Richard was playing at the Roxy every night. And then one night I'd go across the street to the Troubadour and saw the Turtles. And one of the other clubs I'd go to during our break, and the Birds were playing there. But that's when the Strip was the Sunset Strip. You know, it was such a hippie movement back then. You know, everybody was bell-bottom pants and long hair, and it was just such a great time back then. I'm glad I still kept a few memories from that era. You know, I'm a crazy person on saving all the memorabilia. I still have all my wrestling memorabilia, but I still have a lot of pictures from our days when we did tour. Some of my memories with some of the superstars now that were just starting back when we were, especially at one of our first tours with the Beach Boys. But unfortunately, Brian didn't go on those tours back then. But I'd always remember Dennis Wilson, the drummer, would come to our loop back then. Now, of course, the big hotels were back then with the Days Inn. No big Marriotts or any of those hotels. So he would come to out after we'd get through playing at night. Sometimes Dennis Wilson, may he rest in peace, would come by our hotel room, our little room that we'd have, and come in there. And we used to carry, sometimes the restaurants when we got out at night were closed back then. And so we'd always carry like peanut butter and jelly and, you know, loaves of bread with us on that we'd get during the day, because at night when we got out, nothing was going to be there for us to eat on. And usually you had to take a bus tour going to the next town anyhow before we checked in. But loved talking with Dennis Wilson and picking his brain about stuff, especially our drummer Larry Wall did, because, you know, Dennis played drums, of course. Some of the other Beach Boys were nice, but they were a little standoffish. Even among themselves, they didn't seem very close. On the stage, they were great, but they kind of parted ways, you know, when they got out of the buildings. The Buffalo Springfield, Neil Young, Stephen Stills, of course, were just two of the members in that. But it was great talking with those guys. And later on, if you look at one of our Gentry albums, the Sun album, I cut a version of Cinema Girl that Neil Young wrote, because I always loved that song when they did it live that night. When we were playing with the Buffalo Springfield, they didn't even have an album or a hit record out then. So all these songs we were hearing for the first time, Clancy Can't Even Sing and Cinnamon Girl and Burn, which was one of my favorite songs they had out. So it was fun meeting those guys. And then, of course, the first time we did American Bandstand, here we are from Memphis, though here we are from the South going into the room, right? We go into the studio, and who is sitting in the chair getting makeup put on? Dun, 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 Roy Orbison. And we're like, oh my God. And to this day, I wish we'd got his autograph or taken a picture, you know? But, you know, no cell phone cameras back then or nothing. You know, the old, the gimmick cameras that take the little shot, pull the little deal out the back and hope it develops enough for it. After a couple of years, they fade away anyhow. But the Polaroids, of course. But we played with the Grassroots on one of the shows we did with them. Some of the tours we did with the one of my favorite songs, Happy Together by the Turtles. And, you know, we had a great chance of playing the Brooklyn Fox, too, for Murray the K. His last show, his last Easter show was on Murray the K, was at the Brooklyn Fox in New York. And on that show was the Gentrys, us, Joe Tex. We had a guy called Dion who had Love Makes the World Go Round. We had Little Anthony and the Imperials, the Shangri-Las, the Young Rascals were on there, and Martha and the Vandellas. And it was just a great experience. We'd do three shows a day. Everybody would do three numbers. And it was just unbelievable. And it was such a great era back then. And of course, the music's changed so much now. It seemed like everything back then, even if it was a sad song about love, it was still a happy song about love. And that's what everything was about. I really miss that era of music. Matter of fact, every time I get a chance to go see anybody that we toured with, like Gary Puckett and the Union Gap or Gary Lewis and the Playboys, I still go out to see these groups. Well, you know, what happened to the Gentry's breakup took place, you know, year after year when you don't have the hit records and you're still making the towns and all of a sudden you're not... I call it the main event, a wrestling term, but you're not the headliner in the music, and you kind of wind up being the second or third group on the show, which is still decent money. And you look like you might never have another hit record, even though we were trying to, going from different labels to different labels. One by one, some of the members started dropping out, till finally it was just me, Larry Raspberry, and Bruce Bowles together. And then we had other members that toured and played with us. It finally came down to... Bruce leaving, and then one day Larry came to me and he said, Jimmy, he said, I'm going to change my style of music. He said, and the way we had it fixed, every time somebody dropped out of the group, whoever the last person left, except for the previous songs you already cut, anything you did in the future, you would own that name and you would own the rights to it. So it left up poor old Jimmy Hart. There I was standing in my backyard in Memphis, Tennessee in a drizzling rain. And all of a sudden, I'm the last member left. But I didn't have a pity party. I didn't whine, I didn't cry. I put a new group together, and one of the members of the group was a guy named Mike Gardner. Now, Mike Gardner, later on, ended up playing drums for Jimmy Buffett. But he played a lot of studio stuff, and he said, look, I want to introduce you to a friend of mine. His name is Knox Phillips, Sam Phillips' son. The legendary Sam Phillips, who produced records on Elvis, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis. The list goes on and on. So we went to the studio, and as luck would have it, a guy named Shelby Singleton out of Nashville was putting together the brand new Sun label, taking some of the older stuff and putting it together with trying to find some new things to put out. Well, since we had a record from the past, you know, the Keep On Dancing stuff, and had a track record, he took a chance on us. So I wrote a song called Why Should I Cry? You Never Said You Really Loved Me. So we went in and we cut that song, and they released it, and all of a sudden, the new Gentrys, the Jimmy Hart Gentrys, we looked on Billboard, there we had a top 50 song on Billboard. So all of a sudden, we were back on the road again. And then on our first album, I will always remember touring with that, doing the stuff at the Whiskey A Go-Go with the Buffalo Springfield. So I remembered a song that stuck out in my mind so much, and it was Cinnamon Girl. So we went in and cut our version of Cinnamon Girl. We had a top 40 record off that. Of course, Neil Young, his old company, released his version of it, so he had a top 50. But, you know, he got the best of it because he had publishing and writers. But still, we kept going. We had Why Should I Cry, played off it, had Cinnamon Girl. Then I wanted to go to Europe. I convinced our producer, Knox Phillips, Sam Phillips' son. I said, look, if you send us to Europe, I know I can find some music over there. Because the big Beatle invasion was happening, and all the Bo Brummels and the Beatles and Dave Clark Five, all this stuff was going on. And we had played with the Dave Clark Five on some gigs anyhow. So as we were over there, I took my guitar player at the time, Wes Stafford, with me. We didn't know anybody. We got off. We didn't know where we were staying. We found one of those bed and breakfasts down on one of the streets over there. And we were walking by, just minding our own business one day, kind of window shopping, and I heard this loudspeaker come out from a music studio. And it was like, oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. And I went, oh, my God, I love this song. It was a guy called Jimmy Cliff who had this song out. Well, you know, sometimes it's better to be lucky than to be good. Well, Jimmy Hart, lucky day for us. So what happened, we saw where the song was coming out from, and it was a company called Island Records. So we walked inside, introduced ourselves, and we just happened to have an ad in Billboard that day. So the guy, the production guy there, he said, the Gentrys, he goes, you know what? I think I just saw an ad in Billboard. We didn't even know it. So we had a Billboard on another one of our songs coming, a full-page ad. And I said, look, I just heard a song about, ooh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. And he went, oh, my gosh, that's by a guy named Jimmy Cliff. And I went, really? And I said, could I buy a copy? He said, I'll give you a copy. Immediately, we went and shipped that back. Well, matter of fact, they did it for us. We shipped it back to Knox Phillips. He loved it. He cut it. We had to stay there for 2 weeks because we're on those little tours that you save money by staying in the place for 2 weeks, right? We were ready to come back home after the third day. So now we kill our time on it. We come back over to the States. We go in the studio, and all of a sudden, we cut Wild World. We had a top 10 record off of it on Easy Listening. And it got 98 on the pop charts. But so we did a little run off that too. So we had three chart records with our new Gentry group. And then finally, you know, that falls apart too. You know, when you don't have hits anymore, then you start playing the clubs. You know, say, hey, the more you drink, the better we sound. Hey, happy birthday to Mary tonight. Let's all sing happy birthday, you know. So that got a little old. But that was close to the end of the musical thing as far as the Gentrys went. Well, the call from Jerry the King Lawler, I'll never forget it. Well, what happened when we were playing, we wound up playing a place called the Ramada Inn in Memphis, Tennessee on Lamar Avenue, about 5 or 6 blocks from Elvis's mansion out there, which is out in Whitehaven. So Lawler and them would come, when they'd go to Tupelo on Friday night, and I love wrestling. Jerry and I knew each other, and I was doing a little things for them off and on TV, and a little music here and there. But Plowboy Frazier, Billy Superstar Dundee, and Jerry Lawler on the way back from Tupelo would always stop off because Plowboy Frazier loved getting on stage with us and singing, "The Thrill Is Gone," B.B. King song, "The Thrill Is Gone Away." And we'd all sit there and go, oh, that's great, Plowboy. But a lot of fans love wrestling, so they'd come to see us, but then they got that extra treat every Friday night by seeing Jerry the King Lawler, Billy Dundee, and some of the other wrestlers come in there. So Jerry goes, look, I'm cutting some videos. I'd like for you to be involved and help me on it. But he goes, look, I know during the week you play the Ramada Inn, but during the day you're free. How would you like to work for our wrestling company, Memphis Wrestling, and do promotion for us? And then you could still play at night over here at the Ramada Inn. Because we were doing 2 shows a night. We didn't even start till 9 o'clock. And I went, I love it, extra money too. So the more I got into it, the more I loved the business, because what happened as a young kid, I always loved the wrestling. Ever since my uncle, JB, took me to wrestling, every summer I'd go down to Memphis, I'd go down to Jackson, Mississippi. And while I was down there, he would always take me to the wrestling matches. And I always looked so forward to that. So I really loved it anyhow. So meeting Jerry the King Lawler and being with these wrestlers, I mean, I was in heaven. Music and wrestling, what else can you ask for? So I started doing promotional for Jerry, and one thing led to another, you know, and then finally I just kind of gave up. I still owned the Gentry name, but decided not to play regularly with the Gentrys anymore, except unless we just do kind of independent shows 1 or 2 a year, and I might put something together for that. My early memories working on the music with the King, so I'll never will forget it. Jerry called me one day and said, Jimmy, are you available this weekend? And I said, yeah. He goes, listen, I'm going over to Ardent Recording Studios, and I'm going to do a wrestling album. I'd love for you to help me on it and be involved. So I went over there, and Jerry really, we both became good friends after that. What happened is we were sitting in the control room after we did one of the songs, and we were listening to the playback. So the guys in there, they passed a wine bottle around. It came to me, and I said, I don't drink. I passed it to Jerry, and he goes, I don't drink either. I went, oh, that's pretty good. So then the guys lit up a little doobie and passed the cigarette around. I said, I'm sorry, I don't smoke. They passed it over to Jerry. He goes, hey, I don't smoke either. So I thought, well, that's pretty darn good. And I loved playing ball in school, and he loved playing ball. So, you know, every weekend we'd go out and we'd play either touch football or softball or whatever on the weekends when Jerry was off. So that's how we really started a good bond back then. That's how I ended up singing on some of Jerry's first albums that he put out. And then later on, that led to me cutting, of course, some wrestling videos. Well, I went back in the day when we put all this stuff together, the music stuff together, the way it really worked back then was we had a studio musicians, and we'd go in, and Jerry had the list he wanted. I think he wanted to do a song, Happy Go Lucky, and some things like that. I think one Beatles song on that too. He did a couple of numbers, and he did Bad to the Bone and a lot of cover songs, nothing really original back then. And I really wasn't, I was writing a little bit, but not, you know, regularly trying to make a living off of it. So we did the albums, we did all that stuff, and then that led to me doing a lot of stuff promotion-wise with their company, like I said before. Then one day Jerry Jarrett came to me, and he goes, Jimmy, we've got a guy in town called Handsome Jimmy Bay. And I said, no, I love him on TV, because Handsome was really flamboyant. You know, he'd come from New York, and up there it was more showmanship, and his interviews were great. And he said, can you cut a song on him? And I said, yes, yes. I didn't know if I could or not. I didn't know if he could even sing, which he really couldn't. But me and my friend, we wrote a song called Son of a Gypsy. You know, I come, you know, flying into Memphis, TWA, tell all the ladies, Handsome Jimmy's on his way. And we had kind of the old rock thing behind it. So I took him to the studio, I cut the song on him, they gave me a camera crew where I could use the video for TV. Now in the meantime, Jerry Jarrett had come to me and said, look, we love you, we're going to give you X amount per week to help do publicity for us, but whatever you want to do, whatever Lawler wants you to do, you just, whatever he needs, you help him. I went, okay, great. I want you to remember what I said, whatever Jerry Lawler needs, you help him and do it for him. Got that. That came from Jerry Jarrett, okay, who ran the territory, the promoter. So we'd go and promote towns like Blytheville and Jackson, Tennessee, Blytheville, Arkansas, Jackson, Tennessee, Tupelo, Mississippi, you know, places like that. So one day Lawler goes, look, don't go to Tupelo tonight because, no, excuse me, don't go to Blytheville tonight because I want you to do this musical concert with me. I said, okay, great. Now remember, Jerry Jarrett's the one that told me, whatever Lawler wants, that's what you do. Okay. So we do the concert. The next day I go to TV, Saturday morning. I pick Jerry Jarrett up at the airport, and he goes, how did Blytheville do last night? And I said, I don't know. And he goes, why? And I said, well, I wasn't in the town. He goes, why weren't you there? And I said, well, I was in a concert with Jerry Lawler. He goes, oh, how did it turn out? I went, oh my gosh, it was sold out. About 1,000 people for it in a movie theater. He goes, okay, that's good. So he goes to TV, and he finds out that Blytheville that night only did about $600. Well, it wasn't because I didn't promote it. The card was not very good. You know what I mean? So that took place. So when the TV's over, Jerry Jarrett comes to me and goes, Jimmy, we love you, but I've got to teach you a lesson. He said, you got to be fired. I said, fire me for what? He said, for not going to the wrestling show. It only did $700. And you went with Jerry Lawler, and y'all almost had 2,000 people there. I said, but you're the one that told me if Lawler asked me to do something, do it for me. He goes, well, I did, but on this case, hopefully we'll use you again. Well, buddy, you could put a knife in my heart because I love the business. And I stayed there at Channel 5 TV as all these cars drove off on a cold day. I'll never forget it. And I said then, you know what? If the wrestling business is like this, I don't want to be part of this at all. And I made my mind up. But in the meantime, I had that song that we cut on Jimmy Vallant, the master for it, and we shot a video on it too. So I didn't say nothing. I let them ride off in the sunset. Lawler called me and goes, what happened? I said, King, you own part of the territory. I did what you asked me to do. And now you don't go to Jerry Jarrett and say, hey, look, Jerry, here's the situation. I asked Jimmy to do this. You told him to do what I did. So I don't think that's right. But he didn't do it. So I said, okay. So I went back home and put my little Gentry stuff together, started doing some one-nighters again. Well, then all of a sudden, in about 2 weeks, they called me. Jimmy, Jerry Jarrett. Hey, Jerry. Listen, remember when I asked you to cut that video on Jimmy? Yes, sir. Did you do it? Yes, sir, I did. He goes, what about that song? I said, yep, I did it. And he goes, well, I know you played it for Lawler last week. Lawler says it's great, and Jimmy Vallant does too. Well, we want to switch him babyface because he was doing the heel thing then. And so I said, I'm sorry, Jerry. I'm not going to give it to you. And he goes, what? And I said, listen, you left me standing in the cold weather and drizzling snow and drizzling rain on something that I love doing, on something that I didn't do anything wrong on. It wasn't my fault. You asked me to do it, and I did it. And I said, if this is the way the wrestling business is, I don't want to be any part of it. So then, a day later, they had Lawler call me. And I was always a sucker for the King. I always loved the King, you know. He called me and goes, Jimmy, what about the tape? What about this? He goes, you know what? I'm fixing to switch heel again, and I want you to be my manager. Well, at first I was like, ah! I said, I better play a little hard to get. I better wait this out a little bit. Don't seem too anxious, okay? Because it could be another trick. So I said, no, King, I don't want to be part of it. I'm sorry. I don't want to be in this business. It's too cutthroat. Forget it. He goes, do me a favor. Will you ride with me to Blyville tonight and let me talk to you on the way up and on the way back? And if I can't convince you to be my manager, to be on TV, and to give me these tapes back and the record thing, he just, then that's okay. So, of course, I rode up there with him. He said all the right things. So the next thing you know, I'm on Saturday TV, Jimmy Hart managing Jerry the King Lawler. Some of Jimmy Hart's big, big hits from Memphis. Hey, like We Hate School, Lance Russell's Nose, Hippo Hips. Yes, these were the biggies, folks. And Son of a Gypsy by Handsome Jimmy Valiant. And even original version of Eat Your Heart Out, Rick Springfield. But what happened on that, once I got my foot in the door with the King and started doing my wrestling, I started doing a little bit more songs for these guys because we did videos on them back then. So that's when we did Lance Russell's Nose. So we took video to it and everything else because we had a great guy named Ron West who did all of our videos up there, Jerry Jarrett's son-in-law. So what we do, I'd write the song, send it to them, and they'd put these videos to it. Well, by doing Lance Russell's Nose or Wimp Busters and all these songs like that, it just turned out to be really a very lucrative thing locally for us because we'd go back and sell those CDs for like or singles for like $5 each, you know. Because see, back then, nothing was guaranteed money. When you hit the road in wrestling back then and all these little shows that you'd go to, sometimes they let you have a gimmick table too. Sometimes you made more off your merchandise than you did what you made on the house. But that's how I got to write the little funny songs that we did, and they would put them on video for me. And I think that's what really helped Jimmy Hart get over as a character more too, where you just wasn't one trick pony, where you just went out to manage and you went home. You know, people eventually found out that I was writing some of the songs and kind of made myself the laughing stock in some of them too, like Wimp Busters that we cut. And so, and Lawler would always drop the t-shirts or Wimp Busters with my face on it and things like that too, or Lance Russell's Nose, and have me have Lance choking my neck with his nose going way out like this. But those are some of the things that Lawler did for me to make that extra money too. I found a program stuck back in a drawer. It was kind of faded, it was kind of torn. And every time I looked inside, some are gone, some are still alive. I watched them every Saturday on TV. I couldn't wait till they climbed in the ring. And Monday night memories are all I have to remind me of you. Monday night memories are all I have to remind me of you. Well, what happened to me? I had probably the greatest phone call of my life from Hillbilly Jim. Back in the time that we were in Memphis, WWE, or WWF back then, was kind of going into different territories and putting their TV on there. And oh my gosh, I mean, these people were up in arms. All these territories, they were just, oh my gosh, it was like a nightmare. I mean, if you mentioned the name WWF back then, it was like you were committing suicide for yourself. I was in Memphis, and I never will forget it. On that Tuesday, me, the Dream Machine, Coco Beware, and I think Big Joe LaDuke, we were riding together going up to Lexington, Kentucky for that particular shot. It was snowing. We got all the way to Lexington, Kentucky, and there was a sign on the door, wrestling postponed. Nobody even thought to get a hold of us at all for that. Well, that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for me. We came all the way back to Memphis, so I'm sitting at the house, and snowy day, and I get a call from Hillbilly Jim. And Hillbilly Jim calls me and goes, Jimmy, Hillbilly Jim. We knew him as Harley Davidson for us. And so he called me and said, look, He said, you know, WWF's trying to get a hold of you back then about they want to see if you'd be interested in coming to the territory and being part of this show called WrestleMania. Well, of course I would be, but I was scared to death too because I knew I had to tell Lawler and Jarrett what was going to be taking place. And I know they were going to be very, very angry with me. And I said, and what happened before that though is when I was in Louisville the week before, I had a phone call. We'd always, before we'd go eat and go to the building, we'd always, you know, call our homes at home on a payphone back then, no cell phones, of course. And I called home and I said, look, did anybody else call today? And they said, this person, this car, but Vince McMahon called you. And I went, oh, please. And Vince McMahon didn't call me. And they said, well, I got this number here. It's a 203 area code. And I said, well, I'm not calling that number. I think it's one of the wrestlers playing a joke. So I didn't call the number. Another week goes by. Evansville, Indiana, the same thing. Go to the building. Before the building, use the payphone outside. Call home. George Scott called you. Now, George Scott was the booker at the time for WWF. He put all the matches together. So we went up. So I still didn't call the number. So then that's when I was at home during the snow. Hillbilly Jim called me. He goes, Jimmy, Vince McMahon tried to call you. We had George Scott trying to call you. Are you not interested? Interested in what? Going to the WWE and WWF. And I said, of course I'm interested. So he said, well, hopefully it's not too late. He called me back in 5 minutes and he goes, be by the phone. Vince McMahon's calling. And I went, oh. So Vince McMahon called me and said they liked what I did on TV and would I be interested in coming up there? And I said, yes, sir, I would. He goes, well, I'm going to put you on the phone to my travel agency. So he put me on the phone to the travel agency. All of a sudden they go, Mr. Hart, would you like to fly American, Delta, United? Now, I didn't even have any frequent flyer miles back. I didn't even have one little card. So I'm going, well, no, just put me on what you want. No, we want to put you on what you want. I said, no. Whatever you put, because they wanted my frequent flyer number. Well, I didn't want to embarrass myself and go, I don't even have a frequent flyer number. We don't even fly down here. We drive everywhere. So finally, she gave in and she goes, well, how about me putting you on Delta? I said, that works for me. That is phenomenal. Thank you so much. So, I go up there to New York, get off the plane, limo picks you up, takes you to the office. I go meet Vince McMahon, had a great meeting with him. He said, when can you start? I said, when do you want me to? Hey, how about tomorrow? And I said, well, Mr. McMahon, they just sent me the tapes from Memphis Wrestling. Jerry Lawler is over in Japan. He won't be back. Jerry Jarrett's out fishing and hunting. He won't be in town. So they gave me the tapes to take to the show to help run the show that day. And he goes, you know what? If you're that loyal to me the way you've been to them, he said, we're going to have a great relationship. Got on the plane the next day, flew back, did the TV show there, snowing outside, had a small crowd in it, but we knew the ratings were going to be tremendous on that one show, so I thought, what can I do to help me get out of this situation I'm in? And I said, well, you know what? We've got a big flower match coming up this weekend where whoever loses has a big 50-pound bag of flour dumped on their head. So I thought, what I can do is I'll get on TV, demonstrate it to Lance. I can dump this on Lance, and when he does, Lance can go, you're suspended. And I'll just dive underneath the ring, lock myself underneath the ring for the whole show and stay under. That'll be great TV. And plus, I'm really getting suspended, so it really works out. So we did all that on TV. Then all of a sudden, the show's over with. I go home. We're snowed out the next few days. Jerry Lawler comes back into town. In the meantime, I told Plowboy Frazier that I was leaving the wrestling and putting my Gentry group back together again. I lied to him because I knew he was going to run to Lawler and tell him right off the bat, which he did. So Lawler comes to my house and he goes, how was TV? And I said, good. He goes, Plowboy tells me you're leaving. Can I talk to you to stay? And I said, no, sir, I can't. I said, well, Jerry, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm leaving to go to the WWF. He goes, what? He goes, oh, my God, Jerry Jarrett's going to be upset with you. And I said, I'm sorry. So he calls Jarrett. Jarrett says, I'm suing Jimmy Hart. I'm suing the WWF. And I went crazy. I went, sue me? Sue me? I said, I'm suing this promotion for impersonating a wrestling promotion all these years. And so I went to New York, and the rest was history after that, you know. Well, how the music came about for me working with Vince, what happened is when I went to New York, on the first show I got to do was WrestleMania. As far as the live events go, we did our TV in Poughkeepsie, New York, where I wound up managing King Kong Bundy, who I managed in Memphis, and then I wound up managing Greg the Hammer Valentine. And so at WrestleMania, I met a man by the name of Dave Wolfe. Dave Wolf was Cyndi Lauper's manager, and they were part of the Rockin' Wrestling Connection. Well, at the time, part of WrestleMania, there was a two-part of it, the show, of course, but then when it was over, Dave Wolf wanted to bring Dick Clark's people on and Cyndi on and everything and do a rock wrestling album. Well, I guess Dave Wolf had followed my career in Memphis and knew that I did a lot of the music down there. So it kind of worked in great for me. So after the first WrestleMania, a few months later, they approached me about doing a song for the first wrestling album. And Rick Derringer was on it, and of course Cyndi Lauper, and a cast of others, Leslie West of Mountain. And so they asked me, did I have an original song? Well, I knew in Memphis I had a little original song I'd done called Eat Your Heart Out, Rick Springfield, which was a novelty song. I guess I was kind of like the Weird Al Yankovic of wrestling before there was a real Al Yankovic, him doing those parodies. I kind of did Memphis parodies. So I gave him a copy of it. They cut it their way with Rick Derringer playing guitar, Cyndi Lauper singing backup on it. And that's how my musical thing got started for them. So on the second wrestling album, they came and said, look, I know since you did this song, you've been doing some other theme songs. So I said, well, I do have a couple of songs. I have one called Crank It Up, which they did for the Young Stallions. Here's a song for Honky, which they did with Honky on there. And then I had one for the Demolition, Axe and Smash. And so Rick Derringer sang that for me, which was a big thrill because I knew him back from our early tours with the McCoys, with Hang On Sloopy. So we had songs on that album, and then that just led to me doing other songs, me and my partner. I mean, we did so many other theme songs for WWE and WCW. Oh my gosh, performing live. It was the biggest thrill for me because I'm back in my element. I'm back on stage, but this time in front of a few people in a bar. We're in front of 3,000 or 4,000 people on some of the shows that we were doing on promotions for our WWF events back then. So we did the Slammies. So the Slammies came up, and I did a song that I didn't write in that called Girls in Cars, but also I got to do Eat Your Heart Out, Rick Springfield, on one of the Slammies too. And it was a great thrill for me because I had Leslie West playing bass, Rick Derringer on guitar, and it was just phenomenal. I felt like I was back in my element again. And from that day on, Vince kept using me doing other theme songs. A guy for them named Jimmy Johnson writes a lot of the stuff, and he's great doing it. But we got to do Randy and Liz's wedding song together. And matter of fact, I still have a real master somewhere of Randy and Liz singing at my house, just the demo, before I took the demo to Vince. On the wedding song. When you came into my life, you made me realize I was the only one. Then you took me by the hand and made me understand I was the lucky one. And I never felt like this before. Together, just you and me together, our love will last forever. Just you and me forever. Oh, together. Well, you know, from start to finish, the way a lot of the ideas took place with the music, especially up at the WWF, is I'd kind of get with my partner and I'd see somebody who I thought might need a song, and then I'd go to Vince and play it for him. And I'm telling you, I don't think we might have had maybe one thing turned down ever. The Repo Man song, loved it. Snooker song, loved it. The song we did for Greg, Honky Tonk Stuff. Everything I did, I tried to really fit that character that I was hoping Vince wouldn't turn us down on anything, you know, which he didn't. Even together, like I said, the wedding song by Randy and Liz, he loved the lyrics for that. He loved the everything about it. Jimmy Johnson kind of jumped in and put a bridge to it for us, which he did a great job of doing that. But like I said, nobody really kind of directed us in any direction. It was so great back then. I mean, you had access to Vince all the time, you know, because he was with us all the time. And you didn't have to knock on a door and go have a big private meeting with him or set something up a week ahead of time. He was like one of the boys. Well, the way we recorded some of our music was kind of all over the place. I'd call my guy who was helping me write at the time, Jim McGuire. He lived in Somerset, Kentucky. So I knew if I was going to be in Indiana or Kentucky anywhere, I'd buzz him ahead of time. And back then, we traveled, you know, the company would fly us themselves, but we were responsible for our own rental cars. We were responsible for our own rooms. We could stay anywhere we wanted to stay, but we just got to make sure we were at the building on time. So that worked out great for me. So I'd call Jimmy, and if I was going to be on a 4 or 5 day loop in Kentucky or Indiana or around the Tennessee area that he could drive and meet me, then what we'd do, we'd just go in the same car. He'd stay in my room, double beds, of course, but he'd stay in my room with me, and we'd set the stuff up there, write it, demo it, and then whatever town we might be in for studio, Vince and then would rent the studios there in the towns to go in and let us cut the stuff. But I'd let them hear the demo first to make sure they liked what they heard. Well, the setup to do it was kind of really prehistoric according to today's times, I'll tell you. We just had like a little a recorder, and what we'd do is we'd go in and we'd go over it a couple of times and try to get it on one take, vocals and all, just enough to let the powers to be hear it. Then if they liked it, then we'd go in a major studio. But, you know, the equipment back then we used, if you look back on it, I don't know how we even came up with anything, if you want to be honest about it. At the time, we didn't use a lot of studio musicians. JJ would come in and we'd put down the tracks. He'd play a little guitar, keyboards, and then we'd overdub it, and we'd do our vocals and stuff. And then as far as the Rasters go, we'd get them in, and I'd get in front of them on a mic. Sometimes they didn't sing and couldn't get it the right way on the timing on it, so I'd set a mic up for me, a mic up for them. We'd put a shield in front of us, you know, like a separate little booth, but the windows, they could see it. So I was soundproof, they were soundproof. But I'd do it like they would see me, like if it was the Rougeau Brothers, All American Boys, you know, it's from Montreal to Memphis, Parlez-vous Francais. And they would see me mouthing and they would sing at the same time, and I'd put my voice on with them, but then I'd take my voice off. So they could kind of really sing along because they could hear me in the headsets and I could hear them in the headsets. So I just pulled my voice out of it, but they would sing along with it after we went over 4 or 5 times, you know, and I'd just give them the cue. Come in, you know, and then they could see me through the little glass booth on my side, because they were just those portable little stands back then that you could roll back and forth. From Montreal to Memphis, Parlez-vous Francais. Tell all the girls the Rougeaus are on their way. They don't like heavy metal, they don't like rock and roll, but all they like to listen to is Barry Manilow. They're all American boys, all American boys, all American boys. They're all American boys. You know, Jimmy Johnson's involvement with the music was already in place when I got there. So we didn't want to step on his toes, and a lot of the stuff he wrote I thought was great. But our stuff was just a little bit different. For the heels or bad guys, I'd always write something a little funny where we could kind of laugh at ourselves, or the fans could too. Like one of the words to the one of the little lyrics to the Rougeau Brothers, we don't like heavy metal, we don't like rock and roll, all we like to listen to is Barry Manilow. Well, that means the wrestling fans would boo the heck out of them, because you really wasn't hip if you were a guy and your favorite group was Barry Manilow, you know? So I always tried to make stuff that people either make fun of us or laugh along with us. Johnson's stuff was a little bit more serious, which made it a great combination because everybody just didn't, everything just wasn't heavy metal or everything just wasn't funny. So that really worked out good for us. And Johnson's still a good friend today. Reaction to the music by the wrestlers. What I've found in this business is this. It seems like everybody in wrestling wants to be in music, and everybody in music wants to be in wrestling. From some of the biggest names out there, when WWE has their pay-per-views or has their WrestleMania shows, you will not believe the requests from top stars that want to be on those shows. It's crazy. But everything we did with everybody loved it. I know Shawn Michaels, when I took him in to do Sexy Boy, he was a little skeptical. I can't sing. I don't know. I can't carry a tune. Oh, we got the studio, and it was all of a sudden like he was working me. He got in there, and he, okay, what are the words? We held him up. I think I'm cute. I'm so sad. I mean, what a showman. When you see him in the ring, how good he is in the ring is really how he performed when we did the song, because while he was in the booth doing it, you know, he wasn't just standing there like a stick man. I mean, he was moving and singing and everything. And same thing with Sherry. Honky Tonk Man, every time we'd cut something with him, he dressed in his full Elvis outfit. How do you dig that? I mean, it's crazy. So these guys really love doing it. Well, you know, some of the WWF wrestlers really had musical talent. I knew some of them in Memphis before I came up there, like Coco Beware. I managed him in Norvell, Austin, and Memphis as PYT Express, the Pretty Young Things. And I knew he could already sing. I knew that when I did the stuff with Sensational Sherry, I'd heard her before singing kind of off and on in some of the dressing rooms, so I knew she had a little musical talent. Even Shawn Michaels, when Shawn always told me, I can't sing, but he did a great job on Sexy Boy, one of the songs that we wrote. The Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, he said, I can't sing, but I can talk the heck out of a record. So that's how we kind of did that song around him, The Million Dollar Man, Everybody's Got a Price. And Hulk was musically inclined. You know, he played bass in a group called Ruckus before he got in the wrestling business in Tampa, Florida. And Honky Tonk Man, he could actually sing a little bit. All the stuff we wrote for Honky, it was a kind of singing, talking thing, but he was able to do it really, really well. So a lot of my stuff we did, we focused on him. The Rougeau Brothers did a great job, All American Boys. When we did the Rougeau Brothers song down in Memphis at Sunry Studio, recording studio, we used them doing their vocals. I got long sideburns and my hair slicked back. I'm coming to your town and I peek at it like I'm just a honky-tonk man. I'm just a honky-tonk man. I'm just a honky-tonk man. I'm cool, I'm cocky, I'm bad. I got piggy soup beside me. The colonel's in the back. I'm coming to your town and my pink Cadillac. I'm just a honky-tonk man. Woo! I'm just a honky-tonk man. I'm just a honky-tonk man. I'm cool, I'm cocky, I'm bad. I'm just a honky-tonk man. I'm cool, I'm cocky, and I'm b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b- Well, we did a little thing called a hunk, a hunk, a honky love for Honky Tonk Man, because I knew the other ones, we were planning a lot, but we always liked to have Honky, when he went out, to go, "Colonel, I think they want to hear me play this again." Of course, everybody go, "Boo, boo, boo," and we'd always play it again. But we had a lot of fun doing a hunk, a hunk, a honky love. It was a little different than, it was a little harder than the other song we did for Honky, you know. Also, we had one that never got released called Honky Dog Baby. So just to let you know, that might be in the coming out later on this year. But Honky was always so professional. I'd write the songs, me and Jim McGuire would give them to him, let him listen to it, and let him kind of have his own style doing it his own way. But it always came out good. But all the wrestlers, everything we brought to them, nobody forced them to do it. If they didn't like the song, and we always gave them approval. If you like the song, we'll do it for your theme song. If you don't, don't. Especially with Dusty Rhodes. I was such a fan of Dusty Rhodes back when I was in the music business. When we toured Florida with Dick Clark, I'd get up every Saturday morning, turn the TV on, just to watch Florida Championship Wrestling. And to hear Gordon Solie at the end of it go, "And so long from the Sunshine State." What a great way to end it. But Dusty Rhodes was always one of my favorites, and I loved his interviews. And so when I had a chance to write a song for Dusty, it was just such a thrill to me. How did we find the singers for some of the songs that we didn't do the wrestlers on? Well, it was pretty easy, really, because still to this day, when you mention the word WWF or wrestling, you know, people just love it, whether they grew up on it, whether their parents watched it before them, but they still want to be part of anything that lets them be part of doing something like that. So having the singers was easy. We just called different people that we thought had a voice that would fit on it. American Made, Todd Plant in Tampa had a good raspy voice. We let him sing American Made. The couple, I forget their names now, that sang the Together song for Randy and Liz. They were really, really wrestling fans and put more into it than just hiring a studio musician going, "Hey, can you sing this song here and we'll give you $150. Feedback from the fans on some of Jimmy Hart's most popular songs. Well, everybody, of course, loves Sexy Boy by Shawn Michaels. Later on, the Demolition song, because it was a little bit heavier, loved that. Honky Tonk songs, it was kind of a love-hate on those. I think the people really loved it more than they hated it, but they wanted to play like they hated it because they hated honky so much back in the day. But for some reason, the Rougeau Brothers, people always liked the Dadgum Rougeau Brothers song. I don't know, because maybe it was nerdy or something, I don't know. But they liked that. The Mountie, when we had Jock finally doing the Mountie, we had a hard time for him to do that because he was convinced that on the line where it goes, "I'm the Mountie, I'm happy, I'm gay," he goes, "Wait, no, wait a minute." I said, "Jock, that means happy. Oh, I see what you mean." I said, "You put the wrong meaning to it, Jock. You had the wrong meaning, not us." So we always got a lot of good requests for that too. The way the songs were started, 90% of the times, I'd have my auto harp. I have a 15-chord auto harp that I turn around backwards. Cyndi Lauper plays it. She strums it like this, but I turn mine backwards so I can hit the notes upside down and strum it with my right hand. But it's just an easier way for me. So what I'd do is I'd find what I thought we'd like, take it to the studio. I have two guys that helped me, Jim McGuire, early songs, and for all of our WCW music, it was Howard Helm. And Howard has a studio, so we'd go in the studio, put the chords down, transfer it over. He'd add the drums. We'd have a guitar player come in, because I always like to have real guitars put on everything, you know. It just seemed like it sounded better. We'd have the drums, we'd have everything. If we needed strings, he could put them on there. And then we'd go out, if we needed like Huckster in Heaven, if we wanted a whole choir, then we bought in the Baptist Street choir to do it for us. So, you know, all of it was, it started off simple. Some of it got a little more involved than other songs, but it was always fun for us and fun for the wrestlers that did it. Well, what happened to us? Back in the day, nobody got behind the curtain. Nobody saw what this business is really about. It was more tongue-in-cheek, you know. But we never let anything out that here Jimmy Hart wrote Sexy Boy by Shawn Michaels, but yet we're fighting him, you know what I mean? So that was all kept secret. Now, a lot of people know that Jimmy Hart did the wrestling theme songs, but they seem to be okay with that. I think it would insult their intelligence back then if they knew that Bret Hart, I did the Hart Foundation theme song, and all of a sudden we're fighting Shawn Michaels, you know? So we kept everything kind of behind closed doors back then. It's a lot more open now, and people know who wrote what, who did what, who rides together, who stays at the same hotels together. You can always see if there's tragedy, if there's ever a death involved, everybody gets on stage and holds hands, and then when it's over, they go back fighting each other. But it seems to work. You know, the crowds are still good for WWE.
He thinks he's cute. He thinks he's sexy. He's got the looks that drive the girls wild. He's got the move that really moves them. He sends chills up and down their spines. He's just a sexy boy. Sexy boy. He's not their boy toy. Boy toy. just a sexy boy. Sexy boy. He's not your boy toy. Boy toy.
Well, how I got involved with the music for WCW, it was kind of a crazy. Hulk and I were filming a show in Universal Studios over at Disney, Disney and Universal, called Thunder in Paradise. Eric Bischoff and his crew had been shooting some shows over there, so they knew that Hulk and I had just left the WWF, and we were kind of free agents at the time. So they had asked about Hulk and myself joining WCW, so the contract got worked out, so we came down. And Eric and them at the time had been using these sound bites, incidental songs, where there was a catalog out there that you could pay on and use these songs for the X amount of years, or 6 months or years, according to how much you kept updating it. But it's stuff that you could never put on an album, you could never really do anything with. So they thought about doing original stuff. They knew I'd done some stuff Eric did up in New York. So he said, how would you like to come on board with another job and do a lot of our music? And I said, oh my gosh, I would love to do it. So that's when I used Howard Helm out of Tampa. We have a studio there. So every time somebody needed a song, we'd go in the studio and write something for them. It started out, I think our first song with them was American Males with Buff Hat Bagwell. And we did that. And then all of a sudden we started writing the Nitro Girl themes and a lot of the things that we did, the NWO song for them, the Wolfpack song, and it just escalated there. I think we wound up doing about 102 songs all together, which is in their catalog down there. So when WWF came in, when they bought all the tapes from WCW, they thought they bought the music rights too, but they really didn't buy the music rights. So right now, we're in kind of a dilemma because WCW owns the publishing. Howard and I have the writers, but if WWE uses those songs, there's no way for them to make money off of them because off airplay, Howard and I would make the airplay money. WCW would make the publishing money. So that's why you don't hear a lot of those songs on any of the tapes that you see coming from WCW that we did back then. They took the songs off, and Johnson is kind of redoing some of the songs for them. So a lot of the fans have been upset with that because they want to hear the original songs. So we're making an effort now through our lawyers to see if we can work some kind of deal out with WCW that we can release finally a WCW 40 song album. Well, in the WCW there were so many different styles we had to kind of look for and try to get music for. And it was kind of crazy at first because they would come to us and go, look, we need a song for Disco Inferno. We also need a song for Liz and Randy. We'd also like to have a new song for Hulk. So we'd, on my days off, we'd go into the studio and I would take a video and put it on TV. They gave me everything we needed to supply ourselves with. I would take a video, put it on TV, and let Howard look at the way they came down the aisle, look at their characters. So that way it really helped us sitting down writing these songs. It was really kind of a shortcut doing it like that. But it was a lot of fun too. And nobody does, it was kind of like doing a movie, a score for a movie, you know. I guess they take it, what I've seen before, they look at a movie and see, oh my gosh, here comes the girl that's walking down the hall and we know that there's a monster in the house. So, you know, they put the eerie songs behind that. So it's kind of the way we did everything back then. And it really helped us very much. Like Diamond Dallas, he was kind of, you know, he got with us and said, you know, I want something close to grungy type stuff. So we were able to do that. Somebody else would go, I want something really happy, a happy feel-good song with their character coming to the ring. So it was challenging, but it was a lot of fun.
I like NASCAR racing, Richard Petty is still the king. And I like to eat at the Waffle House, smothered and covered on everything. But there's one thing that I hate, cause it's a bunch of crap. I hate rap. I said I hate rap. Cause rap's a bunch of crap.
I always liked working with Curt Hennig because Curt was a big fan of country music. He loved Willie Nelson. He loved all those tearjerker songs. So when we came up with Rap is Crap, The reason how we came up with that song was because Master P had just been brought on board to do a little angle with out of New Orleans down there with the with Kirk and them. And why call them the West Texas Rednecks? So that's why we kind of wrote the song against rap. Rap is crap. And that was a lot of fun doing that with Kirk. And we had fun with that, even though, but one night when we were doing the deal with him, putting his voice on it, we kept waiting for him. We didn't know what happened. And somehow or another, he got locked out of the building. But the building was soundproof on the part we were in, so we couldn't hear it. We didn't have a buzzer to get in or anything. So we kept wondering, where's Kirk? Where's Kirk? Where's Kirk? Oh my gosh, it's an hour late. It's 2 hours late. What's the deal? So finally, the police came by, and they had an emergency phone call to the place, and they said, look, there's a blonde-headed wrestler that just came to our station down the street and said, can we help him break in to the studio? We said, break in what for? And he said, he's supposed to be in the studio, is he? And I said, oh gosh, yeah. So that was kind of crazy with the police coming down there watching us do part of the West Texas Redneck song, Rap is Crap. Another time, we were in Orlando, and Eric and them had given me the Saturday night show, the 605 show, to do what I wanted to with, because nobody wanted it. So I took the stars that nobody was using. I took Rey Mysterio they wouldn't use, and I took Jericho. I took some of the wrestlers that they were not using on the big shows then, because I felt like they were stars. And as we had three kids that we did, that I wanted to put a group together like the NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. So I called them Three Count. So I got the name copyrighted for them. And we wrote a song, Can't Get You Out of My Heart. And we made these green circles for them to go to the ring to, and we shot a video on them acting like the Backstreet Boys. But the people hated that so much, it picked up so much heat. But they really turned out to be a really good team. So that was just kind of a crazy event that took place on that. Well, the avenues for music after WCW, I thought we're going to be zero, but all of a sudden, a friend of mine, Bron Knobs, came to me and said, look, we've got some people that want to back a wrestling show. And I said, well, look, why don't we have it at Universal? Because I knew Pam Warren up there. I knew her from our WCW days when we used to shoot there. So I went and talked to Pam. They gave us a studio, and the rest was history. We brought in a lot of great names back then. We had Snuka. We had Hacksaw Jim Duggan. We had Hulk Hogan. We had the Road Warriors. We had Bobby Heenan, Curt Hennig. Just to mention a few, but of course with that, you had to have music done. So that was another chance for me and Howard Helm to go back in the studio to cut a lot of original things on some of these iconic wrestlers. And so that's what we did. And we put together a great soundtrack for it all, we thought. We had a great theme for the XWF, and we had the X-Girls out there for us. And so with those girls on there, we had music for them too. So it was the same principle in writing. You know, we just looked at the characters. And, you know, here's Piper's song. We knew that's a no-brainer. It's going to be bagpipes. We knew Hacksaw Jim Duggan. Ho! We know it's going to be dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. You know, so it, like to this day, still some of the best music I thought we did was part of the XWF theme songs. Well, you know, some of the influences on some of the songs we did, especially for the XWF, it was just, once again, it came from the talent itself. You could kind of look at them, the way they handled themselves at the ring and out of the ring, what kind of character they really had, how they did their interviews. And you forget, back then, a lot of the interviews weren't scripted either, so you got to see the real character and not a character that some writer put into this character, which was not really these guys at all. But, you know, there's a little influence on some rock stuff in there and a little bit of country stuff, because a lot of that rubs off on you whether you want it to or not. Like if you're a big fan of Willie Nelson or George Jones, maybe something you were going to do country would have their kind of their vibe in it. My good friend Brian Shields gave us an opportunity about the Legends of Wrestling video game. So when he called on that, I knew what kind of music they were looking for because I'd done stuff with him before. So it was kind of a shortcut getting where we wanted to. The stars he told me he wanted to use, we wanted to go back in. Even though some of those songs were copyrighted with WWF, on some of the games that we did that wasn't with the WWF before that, we I just kind of remembered what kind of theme we had, and we kind of did a different version of that. So it was kind of a good shortcut for us and kind of still stayed in the same vibe for the particular wrestler. You know, the music that we did back then, like I said, we wanted our fans to like it too. I know a lot of people just write to be writing, but we wanted our fans to really be involved, because I've always felt that music was so important to the character. And even now, when you go to a WWE main event or any kind of events they have, as soon as those fans hear one note, they know who's coming out. If they hear, they know that's Shawn Michaels. If they hear, oh, what a rush, they know that's going to be the Road Warriors, a video on them or whatever you might see on it. And even to the Honky Tonk Man's theme, when you hear that guitar go, and that's what we always like to put things on the front of our songs too. American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, where you got the three black girls going, he's American Dream, that cowbell, boom, boom, boom. The fans know right off the bat, that's the Dream coming out. Well, what happened to us, sometimes when you put hooks on the front of a song, you need to grab the fans really quick and fast, because, you know, TV time is so important, it's so valuable. It's like it used to be 15 seconds on a song back in our day, that you had the intro coming in so the DJ could go in. And now, coming up next on WMC Channel 5, you're going to hear so-and-so. So they'd have that little bit of time, so it was always like 15 seconds. So I knew on the beginning of these songs, especially TV time, we had a very limited few seconds to grab the people's attention. So that's what we were always conscious of doing. Well, you know, I still get excited when people come up and go, Jimmy, keep on dancing. Oh, thank you. Or, sexy boy, I love that song. Or, I'm the Mountie. It's still a thrill for me. I feel like I'm 18 years old again. It's really a stretch of my imagination at my age, I'll tell you that. But it's just, a lot of people knew that we did the wrestling, but now they're starting to realize more and more and more and more that Jimmy Hart was part of the music era, because like we said earlier, back then, we couldn't tell the world that Jimmy Hart wrote this song with this particular wrestler, and now my men are fighting him. Well, why did Jimmy Hart write that song for him if we hate him so much, you know? But it's just the way the wrestling business was back then. Now it's a little bit more out in the open, but it seems like year after year, with the technology that's out there now, with the internet and YouTube and all these things and all these videos of some of the songs that we did, and it always says written by Jimmy Hart or whoever, it's really been a thrill for me to let people know that we just wasn't one trick pony, you know, just a wrestling manager, that you could do music and do other stuff. So with this happening now, what we're doing here today and this finally coming out, let the people know what we really were involved doing the music. It's really a thrill for me for doing this. I read it in the paper, I saw it on TV. I guess there'll be an empty seat when I wrestle in Wembley. At first I tore my shirt, then you tore my heart. I knew you were a Hulkamaniac right from the start, 'cause you were my friend. I'll see you again when the huckster comes to heaven. You'll be my friend. The world just lost another Hulkamaniac. And I know Hulk's love will never bring you back, 'cause you were my friend. Well, some of the songs that I'm really proud of being part of, and I just listened to it on the radio the other day, of course, it'll always be Keep On Dancing, because that's really brought us to the game. Without that, I wouldn't be sitting here talking about music now. But Cinema Girl, our version of Wild World was just, I still love to hear that. But for the wrestling song, Sexy Boy, Shawn Michaels, the Honky Tonk Man stuff, the album we did on Huckster, a lot of people don't know, for $9,075, we cut a 10-song wrestling album, and we had two major deals off of it, one in the U.S. and one overseas. So finally getting that record album out, it was just a thrill for me for that too, and we're very proud of all of that. But the American Dream song, I'm always proud of. The Mountie, a lot of songs that people really talk about, believe it or not, are the Rougeau Brothers. A lot of people like the crazy Rougeau Brothers song. But Together, still a great song, especially since Randy and Liz are no longer with us. But it was still one of my favorite songs back then. Well, first of all I can say to all our fans out there, and I don't want to sound so corny or tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, it's right. Without you guys, you know, we wouldn't even be here. And that's the truth. And I've always been so grateful that of all the great managers out there, Bobby Heenan, Mr. Fuji, Fred Blassie, the Slickster, Paulie Dangerously, Jimmy Cornette, Captain Lou. I mean, all these guys are more worthy of a lot of the knowledge you have given them, the mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, you know? And I'm just so grateful that y'all kind of latched onto the character. And whether you booed me or whether you cheered me, without you guys, we'd be nothing. So all I can say is this, don't send me no flowers, because I ain't dead yet. We still got one last bit of gas in the tank.
Before it was cool, who would ever think that I'd live out my dream and wind up on the cover of a wrestling magazine? Hogan is American made, and the only real giant is still Andre. Jerry Lawler will always be the king, cause we are the legends of wrestling. Roddy Piper, Bret the Hitman Hart, Bruno Sammartino, they were legends from the start. Mr. Fuji, Bobby Heenan, and the Macho Man, and even Captain Lou, they will always be my friends. Hogan is American made, and the only real giant is still Andre. Jerry Lawler will always be the king, cause we are the legends